Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
You can all hear okay? Well, I really enjoyed Tim's afternoon talk yesterday. It was very, very interesting, all the things that he was talking about. And it rhymes a little bit with what I want to talk about this morning. It's a story from the life of the Buddha. Most people, I think, don't know about this story, especially the details of it, which are quite interesting. It's a story about how the Buddha had a lot of trouble with one of his disciples, Devadatta. Quite a bit of trouble. And this story took place when the Buddha was 72 years old. And starting from nothing at all, at the age of about 29 years old, the Buddha began going forth in India and teaching. And by the time he was 72 years old, the Buddha Sangha was really big. It was all over India. And there were not one center, but many, many different groups of monastics, each of which had its own teacher. And all of these groups looking to the Buddha for leadership and inspiration, occasionally coming together in large numbers, but most of the time in smaller bands. I think everybody does know that the Buddha left home when he was pretty young, and there's a lot of controversy about that. Maybe he was being irresponsible and so on, but he left home. But I think that not many people note the fact that he came back. He actually came back after a while. And pretty much everybody in his family joined the Sangha after he came back. His stepmother, Mahapajapati, was the first Buddhist nun. His wife, Yasodhara, also became a nun. His sister, Sundari Nanda, became a nun. His son, Rahula, became a monastic. So the whole, his father became a lay follower. So the whole family actually rejoined with the Buddha in a new family relationship after the Buddha left home. And Ananda, the Buddha's attendant for many years, was the Buddha's cousin. Many of his cousins and close relations also joined the Sangha. And Devadatta, about whom this story is, was also the Buddha's cousin. He was Ananda's brother. So Devadatta was one of the leaders of the Sangha. He was independently leading different groups, but somehow he wasn't satisfied with this. He wasn't satisfied with things the way they were in the Sangha. And he somehow felt the need to oppose the Buddha. He thought that since the Buddha was older and he was, you know, getting kind of soft and nice and kind, that this was no good for the Sangha. How are you going to whip people into shape, you know, if you're just nice and kind and everything? So Devadatta thought that the Sangha had become a little bit lax and it needed to be strengthened. So he proposed some more stringent monastic rules, and the Buddha rejected those rules, and Devadatta felt this was a real mistake and it was going to make the Sangha too soft, and he just thought the Buddha was too old at this point to lead the practice. And the thing that he should do is step aside and appoint him, Devadatta, to be the leader of the Sangha. And so he was a pretty charismatic, strong teacher, Devadatta, so he went around kind of saying this. And of course, everybody got really upset about it, and they came to the Buddha and they said, "You should put a stop to this. This is terrible." And the Buddha said, "Well, don't worry. You know, everything will be fine. You didn't do anything, old guy. You know, what's he gonna do?" So this went on for some time, and finally there was a big public assembly in which many groups had come together. And in this public assembly, Devadatta stood up and said to the Buddha, "I think you're getting just a little too old and soft, and we should have other rules, and I think you should step aside and appoint me to be the head of the Sangha." And the Buddha said, "No, I don't think I want to step aside just now. And even if I did, I would not appoint you, Devadatta, to be the head of the Sangha, because I think you're not quite yet mature enough for this role." Which, of course, really pissed Devadatta off. So he then openly broke with the Buddha and began trying to speak to the Buddha's disciples to leave the Buddha and come and join him. And many did. Many hundreds and hundreds of disciples did join Devadatta. He was apparently a very strong teacher, very wise, very charismatic. So this was even more upsetting, you know, to members of the Buddha's Sangha, and they said to the Buddha, "You have to do something, you have to put a stop to this." And the Buddha said, no, you know, it's all right, don't worry, it'll all work out in the end, everything will be fine. Well, in those days, spiritual teachers often had the support of rulers, princes, kings. Nowadays, when you think about let's buy a Dharma hall, you get a headache immediately thinking of what it would take to raise the funds. But in those days, there were no such headaches. You just went, and a king came forth and said, "How about if we make a monastery for you here, and then maybe another one over there?" And sure, thanks. And the Buddha had a lot of different places to practice all around. And one of his great allies was King Bimbisara of Magadha, who had a son named Ajatasattu. So Devadatta made a connection with Ajatasattu, and he said to Ajatasattu, "You know, I think your father's too old. I think he should step aside and appoint you king." And Ajatasattu thought, "Yes, this is a really good idea." So one time when King Bimbisara was away somewhere, Ajatasattu sort of said, "Okay, now I'm king. That's the end of him." And Bimbisara came home to find this the case. And he didn't know what to do, so he went to the Buddha and he said, "What do you think I should do?" And the Buddha said, "I think you should be kind and merciful." So King Bimbisara said, "Well, son, probably that wasn't the best way to go about this, but since you have proclaimed yourself the king, I will step aside. Please be my guest. Please be the new king, and I'll do what I can to help you." Which was really a wonderful thing for him to do. But Ajatasattu and Devadatta got to talking about this, and somehow or other, between the two of them, they worked up quite a degree of paranoia. And around the fact that, well, you know, as long as your father is alive and free to move around and speak, you're never going to be safe. So Ajatasattu, in effect, put his father under house arrest, so he couldn't move around and speak to other people. But this didn't seem to be sufficient, so he began, little by little, feeding his father less food, basically starving him to death, to the point where the king's wife would smuggle in food when she came to visit him. The visits were strictly controlled, And when it was discovered that she was smuggling food in, they didn't allow her to visit anymore, and King Bimbisara died, starved to death in his own kingdom. Well, in the meantime, Devadatta was also in a very similar way, quite paranoid, and thought that as long as the Buddha was around, he was never going to really be able to be successful in his project to take over the Sangha. So, believe it or not, he made three different attempts on the Buddha's life. He tried to assassinate the Buddha three times. The first time, he got a lieutenant to sneak into the Buddha's hut to stab him to death. And the Buddha one time was asleep, and he woke up in the middle of the night. And here's this guy in his hut, standing there like a deer in the headlights, you know, just this. And the Buddha said, "What are you doing here?" And the guy said, "Well, I came here to kill you, but somehow I couldn't do it. I can't move. I just can't see how this is possible." Another time, the Buddha was sitting somewhere minding his own business, and a giant boulder fell off of a mountain right onto him, and he was able to fortunately jump aside in time. And he looked up, and there was one of Devadatta's henchmen up there who had pushed the boulder down on him. The third time was actually the most spectacular, and this one, most people do know about this one. Devadatta somehow commandeered from Ajatasattu's palace a very fierce royal elephant and caused this elephant to rush toward the Buddha, to crush the Buddha. And Ananda was with the Buddha at the time, and you know, yelled and pushed the Buddha aside, and the Buddha said, "No, no, it's okay." And he didn't get out of the way of the elephant. And the elephant came charging forward toward him. And sometime before this, there was a dispute in the Sangha. People were complaining to one another, and there was two different groups with two different teachers arguing over whether or not somebody had broken the precepts, and it was a real mess, and Buddha went around trying to patch things up, and he was totally unsuccessful. Nobody would listen to him. So he walked out of one of the meetings where he's trying to make peace, and when they said, "Buddha, you shouldn't have to worry about this. Let us take care of this." Right. So he walked out, and he walked out of the village, and he just kept on walking. He just kept on walking, and he walked into the forest. And he said, I think I'll be by myself for a while. And he didn't show up to practice period or anything. People didn't know where he was. He didn't tell anybody he was going. And he just sort of practiced by himself in the woods peacefully. And then one of the day he encountered an elephant who was the head of a big elephant band, and the same thing had happened to this elephant. The elephant band were fighting with one another, and the elephant couldn't make peace, and the elephant got disgusted with the whole thing and left. And there they just happened to meet each other in the forest. And this elephant taught the Buddha at that time a foolproof elephant cry. There's a kind of way that elephants make a sound that is a foolproof way of protection. So now, in the present moment, we're getting back to the story, the original story. The elephant's charging toward the Buddha, and the Buddha doesn't step aside. He just makes this tremendous elephant cry. And the royal elephant stops on a dime and puts his head down, and the Buddha pats the elephant, and they walk away together. That was the third assassination attempt on the Buddha. Well, you can imagine what the Buddha Sangha was feeling now. Buddha, you have to do something about this. You've got to stop this. Look what he's doing, this Devadatta. The Buddha said, no, no, don't worry. Don't worry, it'll be okay. So, in thinking about this story, I'm wondering, you know, maybe the Buddha should have retired. You know, why didn't he retire? Bimbisara retired. 70 years old is old enough to retire, don't you think? After 70 years, you've done plenty. What else can you do? It's all going to be downhill from now on, so maybe you should retire. It's a good idea to step aside and let younger people with more energy and vision take over. Then you can kind of rest and relax and don't have to think about anything. And then I thought, gee, I'm going to be 70 pretty soon myself. This is sounding better and better, you know. But then I thought, so what would I retire from? Would I retire from being with my friends? Would I retire from my many friendships and practicing with people, sitting with people? Is that what I would retire from? Well, how could you retire from that, you know? When you're not really doing anything anyway. How do you retire from that? And then I thought of my own teacher. People have been, I mean, there have been, as far as I'm aware, so far, no attempts on his life. But many people have been complaining about him that, you know, he should be retiring. What's wrong? He's like 80-something, 88 or 87, and he's still the abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center. And he still, you know, completely occupies the seat. And I think that people have been complaining for maybe a decade, and I think now they're just tired of complaining. They just don't complain anymore. They figure he'll probably live forever, and you know, the Berkeley Zen Center will rot all around him, and he'll still be sitting there. So I think that there are two exceptions to the law of impermanence. One is my teacher. He's going to live forever. And the other one is my mother-in-law. Who I think I'm convinced is going to live forever. But regardless of... and, you know, by the way, some in Japan, it's not unusual for Zen teachers to retire. They do retire. And they have some little temple or something to go to and practice quietly. And there have been some American Zen teachers now who have retired somehow. I don't know what that means exactly, but they're officially retired. But it seems like from the evidence, from this story, we can kind of get the idea that there was something unbalanced in Devadatta, that he had something more than just a compassionate desire to serve the Sangha. You get that feeling. He was ambitious. He had something to prove. Ambition, you know, I think is something good. To have ambition, to go forth and do things, is a really good idea, and we should honor ambition and venerate it. Thank goodness for ambition. We wouldn't have all the things that make our lives possible without people being ambitious and wanting to go forth and do things. And to be honest, we have to be honest that when there's ambition, it's usually mixed up with some need to prove something or be someone. To think that someone is unselfishly ambitious 100% would be foolish. But how much percent is the need to prove something? Is it 5%, 10%, 20%? It seems like it was too high a percentage in the case of Devadatta. There was something not quite right. We don't know from the story what was unbalanced or painful in Devadatta's heart that caused him to have this tremendous need. But there was too much suffering inside of him, too much of an inner need to be someone. You know, it's not unusual for spiritual teachers in their old age to be problematic. I can tell you many stories of teachers who get a little off, you know, in their old age. And such people can be quite, you know, rigorous and create a lot of trouble. And sometimes the disciples of those teachers have to manage them somehow, you know, deal with them somehow, not let them just rage on but creating trouble. But I think that they have to manage them with love and respect, gently. Because when there's a breach, as there is here between Devadatta and the Buddha, and as there has been, in certainly in Japanese Zen and in American Zen, it's really painful. And everybody suffers, and everybody is to blame in some way. So the challenge is, you know, can we manage difficulty with strength, but with love, so that we don't have a breach? Because when there's a breach, there's pain in everybody's heart, and that pain influences the practice and influences the practice of everyone who comes. So it's very, very important, I think, for there to be always every effort made to have good Dharma relations, even when there are real differences and real problems. It's just like with a parent, you know? Parents get old, they cause a lot of problems, and we would be certainly justified to say, well, you know, forget you, never mind about you anymore. You're too much of a problem. But we can't do that, right? We have to continue to be grateful to our parents and loving to them, even though sometimes they can be quite hard to manage. And I think we should be loving and grateful to anybody, really, who's reached an old age. There's a kind of automatic honor and wisdom that comes with great age, even though it might go along with all kinds of dementia and trouble. I think we owe anybody who's reached a great age a deal of respect and loving kindness. And the fact that as a society, we don't much do that, this is a problem for us as a society. It shows a kind of lack of heart and a lack of real substance, you know, in our world. Well, there's an ending to this story of Devadatta, but let's pause for a moment. I'll leave you with this cliffhanger, what's going to happen next. And talk about something else from the Buddha's life. This is the... So, as I say, the Buddha is now at this point in his life 72 years old. And when you're 72 years old, and I can tell you this from my own experience, you are going to have lost a lot of friends. Your life is not going to be what it was when it was full of people that you knew for a long time. And now, so many people who were formative in your life and really, really important to you will be gone. So at this point in the Buddha's life, Mahaprajapati, his stepmother, had died. His father had died. Yasodhara, the nun that he was formerly married to, she passed on. Moggallana, one of his main disciples, was gone. Even Rahula, his son, passed on at the age of 51 years. And the Buddha, predeceased the Buddha. And now, I want to tell you the story of Anathapindika, who was one of the Buddha's most wonderful disciples. He was a lay person, a very wealthy person, who one of the main places that the Buddha practiced was a place called Anathapindika's Grove. It was Anathapindika, very early on, had offered this beautiful grove for a practice place for the Buddha. So Natapindika was now coming to the end of his life. And I want to share with you from Thich Nhat Hanh's text, his version of Natapindika's practice at the very end of his life. So Natapindika's main teacher was Shariputra. So Shariputra went to him as he was passing on. And he advised him to practice contemplation of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. To put his mind on the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha to ease his physical pain. To visualize and think about the goodness of the Buddha, the goodness of the teaching, and the goodness of the community as he was suffering. And Natapindika did that. And then Shariputra said, lay disciple, Suddhata, which was his other name, his nickname, shorter name, lay disciple Suddhata, let's contemplate together. My eyes are not me. My ears are not me. My nose, my tongue, my body, and my mind are not me. And Suddhata followed Shariputra's instruction. And then Shariputra continued, what I see is not me. What I hear is not me. What I smell, taste, touch, and what I think, none of these are me. And Siddhartha contemplated like this with Shariputra. Shariputra then showed Siddhartha how to contemplate on the six sense consciousnesses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking are not me. Shariputra continued, the element earth in my body is not me. The element water, fire, air, space, consciousness that animates my body, these are not me. I am not bound or restrained by these elements. Birth and death cannot touch me. And I smile because I have never been born, and so I will never die. Birth did not give me existence, and death cannot take existence away. And they practice like this. This is just a few words, but this went on for many hours, practicing these contemplations. And Suddhata really hearing these words, bringing his attention to each step and really feeling it. And suddenly he burst into tears. And Shariputra was startled to see him crying and said, are you upset, Suddhata, because you can't follow this contemplation? And Suddhata said, I am not upset at all. And yes, I am able to follow these contemplations without any difficulty. And I'm weeping because I am so deeply moved. For more than 30 years, I have been lucky enough to follow the Buddha and practice and follow the teachings, and I've always found them wonderful. But never before have I heard a teaching as wonderful as this, and that's why I'm crying. And Siddhartha died later that day. So, I don't know what you think of that, but it may sound a little abstract or hard to grasp, this business of not me, not me, not me. The me part of our lives is the grasping part. And of course, we need that. We need that to get through our lives. But I think as we age, actually, we need it a lot less. And at the last moment, we don't need it anymore at all. In fact, at that last moment, whatever little bit of grasping to me is still there really hinders our path and hinders our happiness. Not me. You know, all this litany of practices and contemplations really means it's okay to let go of this small supposed life and open our identity and our sense of self to something much, much bigger. To see that we have always been much bigger than me. And now, in old age and finally in death, we can really appreciate the largeness, the unlimitedness of ourselves, bigger than life and death. And when I was reading this, it reminded me of, and some of you were there, I know, in 2010, when we were in Japan, at a Heiji monastery, in Hoitsu Suzuki, Shunryu Suzuki's son, who's an older man and abbot of Rinso Inn, and also at that time he was one of the teachers at Eheiji. And so we went to Eheiji, and we had the royal treatment, you know, we were like the boss of the monastery, you know. And so we had a special kind of tea and dharma talk with Hoitsu. And on that trip, some of you who were there knew that every now and then I would sneak off in a corner and be scribbling things down in my notebook, and it became a book called Escape This Crazy Life of Tears, Japan 2010, which is was a poetry diary of that trip. And so I actually was writing down in poetry lines all the things that were happening, and I'm going to read you the lines that describe what Hoitsu said to us that night. And I think you'll see the relationship to what we just heard. So this is quoting from Escape This Crazy Life of Tears. Hojo-san, east, west. A person of Zazen is the same. Grandmother mind, the kind heart, is imagination. Feeling for another, see them as yourself, takes imagination. Imagination expands the heart. One day, woke, heard sound in both ears, sudden hearing loss. My eyes don't work right either. Age is slowly melting my body. With each loss, there's gain. My ears, my eyes, more mine now than ever before. Not so. Sorry. My ears, my eyes, more mine now than ever before. Not. So, when I lose my life to death, will my life be owned by me more than it ever was? Isn't that wonderful? That was one of the great, that was probably the greatest Dharma talk I ever heard. It was so beautiful. Just straight from the heart. And this is an interesting thought, isn't it? Caring for another, really feeling for another, takes imagination. Imagination expands the heart. And the idea that my ears, now that I can't hear so well, are more me, more mine than they were before. My eyes, now that I can't see so well, are more mine than they were before. And when I die, my body may be more mine than ever before. So in this text from early Pali Buddhism, the discussion, the terminology used is non-self or no-self, not me, not me. But in Zen, we say the same thing in the opposite way. Instead of saying non-self, we say true self, real self. It's the same teaching. Recognizing that the life I have always thought I had has never been my true life, my full life. It's just been part of it. When I recognize the empty, the signless, and the wishless nature of my life, how beautiful it is and how fleeting, then I really have my life. A life that's not just an idea in my mind, a little bit of grasping, a little bit of neediness, but it's without limit. And this reality of my life is actually present in every perception, in every thought, in every moment of consciousness. It's always been so. And here, at the end of his life, Anathapindika can see this, and Hoetsu, I think, is seeing it at the end of his life. He was kind of goofed off a lot. One time, I remember 30 years ago, him saying to me, "I got to stop goofing off. You know, I got to start really, start practicing. You know, it's a shame on me." I remember him saying, "Do you know that I'm as old now as Dogen was when he died? When am I going to get started?" And he did get started. He did. So that in death we lose nothing and we can really be happy. So I really appreciate that teaching. Back to Devadatta. So what happened, Devadatta? Well, what happened was Ajatasattu now is king, and Devadatta's sangha is really growing and growing and growing. And another king, the king of Kosala, Pasenadi, heard about this regicide that happened in Magadha, and he thought, "That's terrible. That's terrible. You know, this is not a good king. So I'm going to take back this particular province that I had given to King Bimbisara some time ago as a gift, because he was such a just king. I'm going to take that province back." It was a very wealthy province. So Ajatasattu, of course, was outraged that this province was being taken from his kingdom. So he attacked Pasenadi of Kosala. And there was a big war between Magadha and Kosala, and it was really a bad war, and lots of people got killed, and at first it looked like Magadha was winning, and then it looked like Kosala was winning, and back and forth, but eventually Kosala won. Ajatasattu was defeated and captured. So King Pasenadi went to the Buddha and said, "What should I do?" They were, as all the royals were in those days, and even today, they were all related, right? He said, "I can't, what am I going to do? This is my cousin. my nephew. You know, I don't want to hurt my nephew, but yet he's a prisoner of war. What am I going to do with him?" And the Buddha said, "Be merciful." So Pasenadi said, "Okay, well, I'm going to release you from prison, and you can go home and resume the throne. But to make sure that we continue with good relations and there's no bad feelings, I'm going to offer you," as this was always done in those days and among royalty, "I'm going to offer you the hand of my daughter in marriage so that we'll have connections. And I'm going to give you, for a wedding present, that province." Okay, wedding present. And so Ajatasattu was amazed, you know, by this. Who wouldn't be, right? He was amazed by this. It's kind of like what happened at the end of World War II, right? With the United States and the European powers that opposed the United States. The United States did the same thing. And it worked pretty well for the United States, for everybody. And it worked really well here. Except it didn't work so well for Devadatta. Devadatta. Devadatta, I mean. Because Devadatta, when Ajatasattu reflected on the advice that he had been given that gotten him into this bad place, he realized, you know, Devadatta, that's not so good. The advice was not so great. It didn't really help me. So he little by little withdrew royal patronage from Devadatta. And little by little, Devadatta was losing many disciples. Many disciples came back. There was one episode where some of Buddha's disciples, I think maybe it was Shariputra and somebody, went to Devadatta's group, and Devadatta said, oh good, even Shariputra's like coming over to my side. And they just went there and they practiced together with everybody, honoring Devadatta's teaching and honoring the Sangha. And they practiced together with them for maybe 2-3 months and then left without saying anything, practicing and leaving. And then many hundreds of monastics came with them when they left. So little by little, Devadatta had fewer and fewer disciples, less and less, and finally no royal patronage. And he got sick, very seriously ill. Time went by, and Ajatasattu, in his, you know, he was fine now. He was, you know, in his kingdom, everything was peaceful. But he began feeling really badly. He was in torture. He was tortured, really tortured. Because without a war to fight, without anybody to oppose, he was just left with his own heart, and he began to feel the remorse because of what he had done. It was really terrible, you know, what he did. And he began to feel every bit of it, every bit of the torture. And he was really tortured. He was really upset. So eventually he comes to the Buddha and he asks the Buddha for help. He had not really been, you know, he had no longer was studying with Devadatta, but he had not up to now been with the Buddha either. And now he comes to the Buddha. And he says, can you help me? I'm really tortured. Can you help me? And the Buddha said, well, I'm going to speak to you and everybody here about the fruits of practice. And this is a famous teaching of the Buddha, the fruits of the holy life. And some of these, he was speaking to monastics and he was talking about monastic life, but I think we can understand these fruits in our own lives. He says, first, the first fruit, the first advantage of practice is that we've all been hurt, we've all been abused, we've all been diminished. Maybe we don't have such a good feeling about our own lives. When you practice, when you have the discipline to practice, when you sit, when you are a member of a Sangha, you have self-respect. You really see that you can't but respect yourself. Not because you're great or something special, but because you are doing something that you know is honorable and you're doing it. And like everybody else, you're deserving of self-respect, and that's the first fruit of the practice. Your human dignity is restored. The second fruit of the practice is that when you practice precepts when you take care of your conduct and your behavior, taking care of yourself, taking care of others, pain in your life is reduced. You're more relaxed, more at ease when you know you're following a path of justice and moral conduct. Third fruit of the path is that when you practice, you can't help but confront all of your fears. And when you confront your fears, you're no longer plagued by them. You're no longer scared of them. You can be not afraid anymore of your own fear. And in that sense, you can be fearless. And then he said, "And you know, Your Majesty, if you would practice breathing, if you would practice breathing, and if you would practice full awareness of breathing and meditation, you could experience the happiness of one who follows the path. Meditation brings this kind of happiness." Your Majesty, if you dwell diligently in mindfulness, observing the precepts, you can really see into your own mind. You can see the impermanent nature of all dharmas. You can see there's nothing to grasp. As much as we grasp, that there's nothing to grasp. And when you see that, you no longer have to be entangled by the inner tangle. So you may still have the same problems. Actually, because of what Ajatasattu did, he will never stop feeling remorse. But he doesn't have to be entangled and tortured by that remorse. He can disentangle that tangle and find some peace. And he said, when you disentangle the tangle, it becomes clear to you that you practice for others and you can benefit others, and that benefiting others really brings you a lot of happiness. So those are the fruits of the spiritual path. And of course, Ajatasattu was so moved by all this, and he said, "You have helped me see the true value of the Dharma. You have rebuilt in me that which was in ruins. You have revealed that in me which was concealed. You have shown a path to one who has been lost, and you brought light into the darkness. Please accept me as a disciple, and I will practice." And the Buddha said, "Of course I will." So this is a wonderful story of, you know, forgiveness and repentance, right? And when you think about this story, you know, it tells you the power of mercy. It would have been, we all would have agreed, if Ajatasattu were clapped in jail for the rest of his life, we would all have agreed that he deserved it, and it would be a just desert for him. But instead, he was given tremendous mercy. And that mercy, I think if he had been clapped in jail, he would have been continuing on and on with his bitterness. And if he had anybody who could have gotten him out of jail, he would have gotten out of jail and been a nefarious character in the area, you know. But because he was given a chance to just receive mercy, even though he didn't deserve it, he was then able to turn toward his own heart. And it was his own heart and the remorse and pain of his own heart. And I think every heart, even of the most hardened, rotten person, left to their own devices under the influence of mercy, that person will see through bitter experience the need for repentance. And repenting, going somewhere and finding a way to commit oneself, as Ajatasattu does here, to a different life, makes everything possible. So it's something to think about in all these cases in our own lives where repentance and forgiveness is needed, to think about this story. Maybe it's somewhat idealized, or maybe we couldn't like use it as exactly as a blueprint, but I think there's something in it that's really, really wonderful. But what about Devadatta? This is chapter 78. You know, a path, white clouds. It begins like this. One afternoon, as the Buddha was doing walking meditation along the mountain slope, two bhikkhus arrived carrying venerable Devadatta on a stretcher. Venerable Devadatta's health had been poor for several years, and now on the point of death, he wished to see the Buddha. He had only 6 remaining disciples, having lost even his most fervent supporters years earlier, and his closest associate, Venerable Kokalika, died years before of an unusual skin disease. And during Devadatta's final years at Gayasisa, he had much time alone to examine his actions. When the Buddha was informed that the Venerable Devadatta wished to see him, he returned to his hut at once in order to receive him. Venerable Devadatta was too weak to sit up. He had barely enough strength to speak. He looked at the Buddha and with great pain joined his palms and spoke the words, "I take refuge in the Buddha." The Buddha gently placed his hand on Devadatta's forehead. And that evening, the Venerable Devadatta died. So that's what happened. This went on. This was a saga that went on for a long time. And that's how it ended. So, in a way, it's a poignant story that has a happy ending, I guess you could say. In a way, sad, but happy, because everything worked out in a good way. But it's amazing, really, to think that even the Buddha had these kind of problems. You know, when we have problems in our Sangha life, and we usually think, oh God, you know, if I had been more skillful, if I was a better teacher, if I was a better disciple, this wouldn't happen. But take heart, it happened to the Buddha too, you know. And worse, right? I mean, as far as I'm aware, I don't think there's ever been an assassination attempt in the entire American Buddhism on a Zen teacher or any kind of Buddhist teacher. Maybe I don't know about it, but as far as I know, there's never been. With all the troubles, you know, there's never been an assassination attempt. There's never even been, as far as I'm aware, like a physical assault, let alone an assassination. So when we have troubles in our own sanghas and in our own personal lives, I think that we shouldn't feel too bad about it, because it happens. It happens to everybody, even the Buddha. And it happens a lot in sanghas. It happens a lot between teachers and disciples. Because the feelings and inner currents that arise in these intimate relationships go beyond what we understand. And we're sometimes driven and moved by, as Devadatta was, by things in us that we're not in control of and that we don't understand. So stuff like this is 100% normal. One should never be surprised or dismayed when stuff like this happens. It's totally normal, because that's how human beings are. We do stuff like this. We are very interesting and complicated creatures. Human beings are trouble. That's all there is to it. Wherever you see a group of human beings if there's no trouble now, just wait a while. This is what we do. We create trouble. But, as in this story, the question is not, is there trouble? There will be trouble. The question is, what do we do with that trouble? See? In this case, with a lot of forbearance and mercy and time, and really every single person in the story has a good heart, and every single person you ever meet has a good heart. Maybe it takes 50 years, exactly, a long time, you know, for that good heart to manifest. But it's there, you can rest assured. What do we do with our trouble? That's the question. So anyway, I apologize for, Zen practice is mostly fun and about life and how we can live life in a beautiful way. But for some reason, my entire weekend of talks are all about death and all these terrible things, so I apologize for talking about these distressing subjects. Let's not think about dying until we're dead. So thank you for listening, and I will, in case you don't know, just in case you don't know, today's Saturday, right? That's right. And tomorrow we're going to end our retreat around 2, and at 4 I'm going to be taking off my robe and appearing as a regular guy at the Village Books, where I'm going to be just talking about, I have in the last 6 months, 3 new books came out, and I want all Dharma books in various ways, and they're fun books, so I hope you'll come and join in with us at Village Books at 4. I think it'll be about an hour and a half. Did you know about it? Yeah, okay. Oh, some did, some didn't. Good, so I'm drumming up business. Tell your friends, it'll be fun, we'll have a good time.
You won't talk about death?
No, I promise. No, let everybody know. No death will be mentioned in that reading. But on the other hand, it's been, I'm spending a lot of time in the interview room, and I must say, I'm so happy to hear how beautifully everyone's life is turning out to be. You know, there's so much happiness and so much, and I know there's been lots of struggles, but to be able to sit and witness the kind of happiness and loving kindness that pervades this Sangha is really quite a privilege. So thank you for all of that. So let's end our Dharma talk and go on. Thank you.